Okay, so we're going to talk about Susan Sontag today. This is a very straightforward introduction, but usually I have some like bullshit nonsense that I say at the beginning. I never introduce the writer until like 10 seconds in at least. And which I've just done by putting a giant asterisk next to my...
Yeah, we're going to have to like focus on something. This creates a lot of pressure.
Well, she's really worth focusing on.
Sure, certainly.
I think that's interesting. Your copy of The Sign of Saturn,
yeah,
is like, where? How did that originally get published? It's such a thin, small essay to be individually published like that. That's so remarkable to me when somebody's enough, gets recognized enough where they can publish such a, you know, I mean, it's like, where did that live before? Did it get published as this small book, or did it live in a couple magazines?
It was in the New York Review of Books. It was a series of them, and on Paul Goodman, I don't know Paul Goodman, Approaching Artaud, I know where Artaud is, Fascinating Fascism, Under the Sign of Saturn is about Walter Benjamin.
Uh-huh.
Cyberberg's Hitler is about a 6-hour movie about Hitler that is spectacular. The guy in the back says, my own feeling is that Miss Sontag is more interesting on Cyberberg's film than Cyberberg was on Hitler. And it's true. She really...
But that's...
Really presents the... I mean, it's spectacular. The intellectual force and focus of her is so different than Camille Paglia.
Yeah. But that's what pure good criticism should do, too, right? Is like, it should take that original subject matter and make it more interesting than... Like, that's why I liked reading her essay on Barth.
Right.
Because it's like, I'm not really that into Barth. Like, I think he's kind of... I don't know.
You recreate. In a great essay, analytical essay,
yeah,
you have taken it apart and you are recreating it.
Yeah.
You know, in a critical sense from your point of view, right? So, but you have to pay real attention to the original text. I mean, that's the essence of it.
Yeah.
And that's what she's brilliant at.
Yeah, you got to really dig into it and care. And it's kind of like what Norman Mailer did for me in the Prisoner of Sex is like, okay, now I don't have to read D.H. Lawrence because you've explained him to me. It's like, now I feel the same way about Roland Barthes. It's like, okay, well, you've explained Roland Barthes to me, so now I don't have to read him. It's like a great time saver,
right,
slash more interesting on the original person, if that's even possible. I don't know.
Well, D.H. Lawrence is a remarkable stylist. And, you know, like all artists, whether they're baseball pitchers or whatever, or con men, his style is really interesting, you know, the way he tells a story. So,
yeah.
Unfortunately, Jonah, you're going to have to read, you know, one of D.H. Lawrence's stories.
Well, I have. Yeah.
Oh, which one?
It's been so long. The thing I remember liking the most actually was his nonfiction, because it was so incredibly polemical that it was like you didn't have to take it seriously and you could just sort of let it wash over you, which I suppose is what good fiction is supposed to do. But after being influenced by certain other kinds of fiction from the 20th century.
Oh, sure. But you have to realize that Lawrence was, and that's the interesting point that Camille Paglia makes about Susan Sontag, is that she is a specialist in between like 1890 and like 1935. I mean, there's just an era of modernism,
yeah,
that she's got. And D.H. Lawrence, I mean, he's the first, he assimilated Freud, he assimilated any new people. I mean, he's the first one that created this, just the modernist dedication to the hows and whys of relationships of human beings and all the trouble they get into, right?
Yeah.
But
highly focused
Susan Sontag does mention D.H. Lawrence a couple times in one of these essays. I mean, obviously, she loves D.H. Lawrence, right?
Well, maybe. I mean, she definitely appreciates, as her essay on style talks about, the difference between content and aesthetics, which is what you're talking about. Like, if you're just presenting an aesthetic text, and well, I mean, she's got a It's kind of interesting. I'm gonna try and pull something up really quick here. She's in this interview, and the interviewer contends to her, "A work of art." This is what she said. "A work of art, so far as it is a work of art, cannot, whatever the artist's personal intention, advocate anything at all." And then, but later in the Reifenstahl, about Reifenstahl, which is about fascinating fascism, hard thing to say, is as she goes, "As a film whose very conception negates the possibility of the filmmakers having an aesthetic conception independent of propaganda." So he's trying to point out to her that there's a contradiction in terms of if something is purely aesthetic, then that no matter what, a piece of art will have a life that is contentual. Like it has a contentual component to it that there's.
In the purest meaning of the word aesthetic, yes, it's always got the content of its own beauty. And you know, like I'm all for that, man. I mean,
I'm just realizing, like I've marked so many things in this book, and I realize I needed to put a lot more work into this because I need to like work this out like a lecture or something, like
sure.
just to from the difference of jumping back and forth. But she explains herself quite interestingly, and it's one of those things why writing exists. It's difficult to repeat verbatim without it being sounding like a lecture, you know.
Well, right. And what Sontag's wonderful style is that Camille Paglia does not give her credit for is that basically she is interpreting very strange cultural phenomena like deconstruction and post-structuralism in very understandable terms, and also how people assimilate cultural ideas, right, in order to become more conscious. But there's a real pitfall in all this, you know. You need somebody to kind of like that has the wide enough reading and the training to be able to say, you know, this is pretty much what's going on here, right? And she did it, she does it really well. But you
Well,
have to believe that all this intellectual bedrock, not bedrock, but atmosphere is really important. And that's the problem I have just picking her up right in the middle. It's like, boom, boom, okay, I kind of get it, but it really isn't that important, right? And so I'm still a little ambivalent about it, other than the fact that, you know, I read the essay on Riefenstahl, and which is really good
well, the whole
and
point is.
really, really, really point on, don't you think? And then I love the one on Benjamin. And of course, one's a Jewish intellectual was murdered, and the other one is a was a Nazi darling, right? I have that copy of Nomads of the Desert, I believe, at the store here. I didn't sell it.
Nomads of the Desert.
That's the one she wrote with these beautiful this beautiful vanishing tribe. And
Oh, okay. Well, yeah.
I mean, I could just see Gene Wilder, "Oh, Lenny, Lenny, I love you. Oh, give me those beautiful male bodies, oh, and heroic poses. Listening to Wagner over with their headphones, you know."
Well, yeah, it's like if you just want to make a giant satire out of the whole thing, yeah, it's I who's the modern Gene Wilder? Now my imagination is going to that. I'm like, oh yeah, that's kind of interesting actually.
So anyway, we're doing, you know, a reappraisal of Sontag. It'd be a great lecture because I know Susie is, she might not even be alive. If she is, she's like 90 years old.
Yeah, she's not. I'm almost certain she's
Yeah,
not.
sure. So I mean, you have to do these you know, reappraisals of the 20th century. She was very, the last 50 years, 40 years of the 20th century, she was very very influential.
She's Well,
and for what reason? Right?
That is exactly what is beyond me, because she is in no uncertain terms a pure intellectual. Like she even in the Salgamundi interview, she talks about well. Phone ringing.
Beautiful young women. As opposed to the angry and bitter ex-wives that I have.
Oh, man. I replayed that right before apologetic, and then just... I'll cut that out if you tell me to.
Are you paused?
Well, no, not... I just unpaused it. Do you want to say something?
No, I have a question for Will.
Okay. So... Now I've forgotten what you've just said, but I swear I was going to tie this in. Well, yes, I was talking about intellectualism. Okay. So, feminism in the late 1960s inherited another political rhetoric on the wane, that of gauchisme. One common denominator of new left polemics was its zeal for pitting hierarchy against equality, theory against practice, intellect cold against feeling warm. Feminists have tended to perpetuate these Philistine characterizations of hierarchy, theory, and intellect. What was denounced in the 1960s as bourgeois, repressive, and elitist was discovered to be phallocratic too. That kind of secondhand militancy may appear to serve feminist goals in the short run, but it means a surrender to callow notions of art and of thought and the encouragement of a genuinely repressive moralism.
That's why Camille Paglia loved her, when she talked like that.
Well, they agree, or maybe she hated her when she talked
no,
like
they,
that.
No, they agree completely. No, they agree completely.
Okay.
Camille could have read that, and, I mean, I don't know how old that is, but...
I think it's...
But no, she's absolutely right, you know, and she foresaw it all. And actually, in Camille Paglia's essay, Sontag, Bloody Sontag, she excoriates Sontag for pretty much, you know, abandoning the field of this subject and letting the, you know, the so-called fascist feminists, you know, that take over, right? And all this gender theory in which... You judge your book by how good is the gender approach, right? You know.
Yeah.
And
that's what she did.
But Susan Sontag said it so well there. I mean, the way she places this the three adjectives of you know, hierarchy against da da da, right?
Yeah.
So-called bad against so-called good, and then she reverses it and says, "Wait a second, you've got to have some hierarchies of training." You know,
right,
et cetera, right?
Yeah.
And so she really turns the tables, which shows how brilliant she is. She's not afraid of being able to do that. She'll do these little tricks. So no, that's a great paragraph.
Well, I don't like what I fundamentally don't understand what other people find interesting about the other approach. Whereas, like, no, I'm just going to double down on this thing that we think will give a minor version of progress, but in the long run, it has a catastrophic effect against art and ambiguity and like the ability of aesthetics to have any meaning. And
without ambiguity, there's no aesthetics.
Right, exactly.
That's just how it is.
Right. What, you know, art, if it's art, really has nothing to say, right? It's like it doesn't have, I mean, it has something to say built into it, but that something to say can be quite ambiguous and like, well.
If it doesn't, it isn't.
Right.
You know, but that's what's so the beauty, the mystery of the line drawings of Picasso. How is it that there is so much mystery in his line drawings? You know, it's just this, the minimalism of his line drawings is so perfect and suggestive, you know, of what, right? Just because that minimalism, you know, and the grace of it, right? I mean, that's just the whole magic of... just the whole magic of art is an ambiguity. Everybody knows that, you know. And yeah, the fascists just don't figure it out, man. They just want it all spelled out.
Well, but wasn't that part of her argument about fascism? Is that you can look at Triumph of the Will as a purely aesthetic film. Like that she was defending Riefenstahl in this idea of there is something about that movie, which I've never seen. I mean, I don't know. I don't really know what she's talking about.
I haven't read that in a while. I read it about a year ago, so I don't remember
Yeah.
that little caveat that she gives. And so, but you know, basically the film does have real people in it, right?
Yeah.
Which allows whatever happens, right? There's always ambiguity in real events,
Right,
right?
yes,
So it's not like that's, I mean, my objection, what you're saying is that I'm saying, yeah, when you do a real event, all that ambiguity is there, right? But when you know, plot something out, then everything changes, right? And then whatever preconceptions you have are gonna, you know, either win or lose, right? But
Well, yeah. I mean,
like I said today, when this guy came in, you loved it. He comes in. I like his brother, but anyway, he comes in. And he's got a blue American flag.
Will's chesting up here for you.
Thank
Got
you. He's got his blue American flag, and he comes in here. And right on top of the stack here, as fate would have it, as he comes up to see how much this book is that he wants, he sees Understanding White Privilege. And he kind of picks it up and he says, look at this. Oh boy, you know. So he's already done two things that, but I like his brother, right? So I am being civil. It ruined my day because I spent the last, after they left for 2 hours, I'm going, man, I just wish I could have said something to really do so, to really ruin his day.
I listened to a lecture of that lady's on NPR though, and I was very disturbed by the fascist elements of it, to be honest.
Understanding
White privilege, right.
she was on NPR?
She had a whole
What the
lecture that was
hell?
on NPR.
Oh my
I was
gosh.
listening to it. And what happened was exactly this, okay? She says, "I am a racist." And you know what everybody in the audience did? They erupted into cheers.
It's not the same book.
Yes, it is.
Published by Routledge.
Well, I don't know. Maybe is the woman's name Robin or something?
God.
Well,
Okay, read something else by Sontag.
okay, I can do that pretty easily. This is from oh, someone adjusted my. Okay, this is from The Benefactor, and this is completely just since Will's gone, it's actually fitting. But we'll wait for you. Okay, not so
And it
much.
brought to mind what I was thinking about what Hemingway said. And then right after that, of course, this tall, handsome black guy that's studying sociology, and we're talking about it, and I mentioned it, and I said, you know, Hemingway wrote it in like 1935, the fascists can never do great art because their only method of negotiation is power, intimidation, right? It's just a shell of behavior. There is no interior generosity, right? Emotion.
But that's like the opposite of what Sontag says. That's the opposite of what she says. She says becoming so obsessed with aesthetics is fascist, is potentially fascist. Like,
Well, she's totally wrong.
I, well,
But
yeah, I mean.
again, what, look, you have got to put parameters to aesthetics, right? What is aesthetics? Aesthetics is the study of what is beautiful. That's
Yes.
all it is. That's all it is. And to give it all these moral judgments is just like totally stupid.
Well, no, she has this quote from Nietzsche that's perfect. It's like,
well, who cares?
To understand something is beautiful means to understand it wrongly. To understand.
But
it.
I don't even like Nietzsche that much. So, you know, what are we talking about? We're going round and round. Look, Susan Sontag, nobody can be bright all the time, even me. I'm just saying aesthetics is the study of why we find something beautiful. And to say, I mean, and to generalize about any form of art without seeing it is just like so stupid, you know. I mean, there's nothing to it, man.
But in that terminology, to see the aesthetics of something is to understand seeing something wrong. Like, to understand why we find something beautiful is to understand. So that's why the intellectual part of it is absolutely necessary, because it's to understand your concept of how you view that thing.
And that's absolutely true, and you're absolutely right. That is, there's always a subjective, you know, all your lectures keep going back to the subjective, the truth of the subjective and the truth of the objective, right? And we all have subjective feelings to what is beautiful. Look, I have seen Nazi posters. I've seen Nazi propaganda films. I guarantee you, Jonah, they're not fucking pretty. You know, they're staged, Stalinist, you know.
Well, they're not pretty by today's standards, for sure.
And that's what we love about modern American, advertisements for, at least they're funny, right? At least they're not even trying to be.
They used to be.
Oh, yeah. Geico's still funny. I mean, they still
really?
Sure.
What, you've laughed at an advertisement recently?
I don't see them very often. Yeah, I see them in the morning. If I'm, I see them in the morning when I hit the gym, that's all. And I don't care if they've got somebody that looks funny and dressed up like the guy in the, you know, with the horns on the Capitol building, right? I mean, that's funny. I don't know. Anyway, I think, I don't know how we're going to get this back, but let's just stay away from any general ideas of aesthetics. And
that's pretty difficult, because that's like her whole thing. That's like her whole thing.
Right, and that's, you're right, and it is, and that's where she gets into the elitism that Paglia accuses her of. You have to study art, you've got to see a lot of it, you've got to understand it, and then you can judge it better. But I mean, I run into people all the time, and they just think Steinbeck is the greatest. Well, he is great, right? He wrote 3 books, but that's all. He wrote like 30 books. Most of them are just junk as far as I'm concerned, you know. But 3 of them are really good.
I really like The Wayward Bus.
That's what you said, and I haven't still gotten to it.
Yeah,
so that would be 4. So we'll say 4. But I'm just saying that, I mean, you know, the song and dance of art, I mean, when does it have something and when doesn't it? You know, when is it so intellectual? And that's the other thing I don't like about, you know, that was the one thing. I mean, the Sontag is so confident of herself that she can actually say, in the duality between the intellect and the warmth, you know, the common man, right? Which in itself is a red herring, because, I mean, common men, they're just as fucked up as everybody else, right? They're just as stupid, you know. Warmth of spirit is something that you have to work for, in my mind. And
well, you might have an argument there, but
I'm glad we're getting on this, because, as you know, we always, instead of learning anything, we always just get to listen to me think about what I think.
Well, yes. I mean, what is your capacity to expand on that? All right, if you want to say it's earned, how is it earned? Okay, I will grant you the floor to say how you think warmth of spirit is earned.
I think the whole thing about art is, other than music, in which you can pretty much hear it, right? But as you know from your writing, you can think you had the greatest morning ever writing, and then you'll read it the next day, and you're going, are you kidding me?
That's never happened to me.
Oh, well, good. It's happened to me a lot throughout my life. And the only way I can get over it is by rewriting and constantly looking at what I'm doing and what I want to get to and getting rid of the phoniness, right? And I think that's why I'm happy with myself and I keep writing well and I keep thinking that I want to write. But my full cognizance of how badly I can write and how my motives and my conceptions can be so wrong. I mean, that's what I love about writing. I mean, I'm finding I'm wrong like at least three out of four days of my life, you know.
Yeah.
And let's make other people this, since I do it to myself. And that's what I do enjoy about Sontag. She talks about how the human, you know, the artist or thinker who is constantly looking at themselves and criticizing themselves and not cutting themselves any slack, right?
Yeah.
This is a certain elitist individual, the essence of individualism, and that's what she hates about popular culture. You know, a trippy joke, you know, an easy joke, a little slapstick, you know, a couple of sleazy, chintzy lines. Right, everybody loves it.
Well, really good slapstick is still good, but you know, it's like that. That's like a performance art. That's
I use the adjective of the easy kind of
easy
like,
slapstick.
Yeah, I mean, just like we'll just give it to them here, right?
And then, yeah,
you know.
My God, you had a few different things in that I wanted to go off on.
Great.
Instead, I did the opposite thing, where I just let my mind keep running from idea to idea, which is terrible.
You have to have a little trip hammer, like, okay, what did he say before then? Yeah. And what's he saying now? And I've got to memorize it. Yeah.
Okay, here's
I think you're expecting too much of yourself, Jonah. Yeah. So which one did you think that you wanted to critique?
Let's put it this way, what
Susan Sontag and I agree with, and Walter Benjamin, and this other guy, Walzer, Walzer, thank you. You know, the fearlessness to criticize and look at yourself and go through the, you know, the St. Jerome and the desert cave, you know. Let's do that, man. I mean, all great artists do that. And then you do it, and then nobody will publish your book, right? Or everybody says, if we make a movie out of this, or if it does get published, then they put a movie into it, you know, make a movie out of it. And it's like Hemingway. I mean, that's what really drove Hemingway crazy, was the movies they made of his books, man. But yeah, this is a little too something for, you know, the pop culture, right? So,
he didn't write screenplay books. You know, he didn't, like, I mean, he was so literal in his writing that it's, how could you take something so literal and reimagine it?
He had great dialogue.
Yeah, so either you just do the dialogue word for word, but, you know, that's not a play, that's not a screenplay.
Right, right.
If that dialogue is in the context of that story. Right.
But let's go back to Sontag and Paglia again, because I keep bringing Paglia in as the... as the antithesis.
And I know nothing about
it. Well, I'm just saying, she loves popular culture. She loves it as an intellectual format and as being alive and real, right? Because the real world is real. This is where wars are made. I mean, when Mussolini, you know, it's theater and he's wearing the right stuff. When Montgomery is in Africa, he's got the black. It took Montgomery like a year to figure out that he really liked that black beret. He tried it for cameras, and he would look at it. Seriously.
Oh, sure.
You know, and this manipulation of mass media for political purposes. I mean, Montgomery did it in North Africa, man. I mean, it looked really good on the covers of the newspapers back home. And no, I mean, this is what I admire about Sontag, right? Because I am a Sontagian.
It did, despite your protestations. Well, you know, but she's also so fiercely an individualist that, you know, it's kind of difficult to be on your side unless you literally have that same kind of personality, which I do. Like, there's this passage from The Benefactor, which I can read verbatim, and there's only like three sentences or something where I go, okay, I don't know if I totally agree with those, but it by and large, it's just like, okay, that's who I am. It's like that's who I am. That's always who I was. Okay. I learned that reasoning itself, apart from the particular demands of whatever problem it is applied to, has a correct form, a style, which may be learned as one learns the right way to swim or to dance. If I now object to this style of reasoning, it is not because I share the distrust of reason, which is the leading intellectual fashion in our century. My old-fashioned teachers were not in error. The method of analysis does solve all problems. But is that what is wanted always, to solve a problem? Suppose we reverse the method and proceed from the most complex to the most simple. To be sure, we will be left with less than what we started with, but why not? Instead of accumulating ideas, we might be better occupied with dissolving them, not by a sudden act of will, but slowly and with great patience. Our philosophers teach that the whole is the sum of its parts. True, but perhaps any part is also the sum of the whole. Perhaps the real sum of the whole is that part which is smallest, upon which one can concentrate most closely. To assume that the whole is the sum of its parts is to assume also that ideas and things, or can be made to be, symmetrical. I have found that there are symmetrical ideas and asymmetrical ones as well. The ideas which interest me are asymmetrical. One enters through one side and exits through a side which is shaped quite differently. Such ideas rouse my appetite. But the appetite for thinking must be regulated, as all sensible people know, for it may stifle one's life. I was more fortunate than most in that, in my youth, I had no settled ambitions, no tenacious habits, no ready opinions which I would have to sacrifice to thought. My life was my own. It was not dismembered into work and leisure, family and pleasure, duty and passion. Still, I held back at first, keeping myself free of unnecessary entanglements, seeking the company of those whom I understood and therefore could not be seduced by, yet not daring to follow my inclinations toward solitary thought to their conclusion. During this period of my youth, in the years immediately following my resignation from the university, I took the opportunity to travel outside my native country and to observe the manners of other people and social classes. I found this more instructive than the wordy learning of the university in the library. Perhaps because I never left the country for more than a few months at a time, my travels did not demoralize me. Observing the variety of beliefs in different countries did not lead me to conclude that there is no true right and wrong, but only fallible human opinion. However, much men disagree about what is forbidden and what allowed. Everyone aspires to order and to truth. Truth needs the discipline of custom in order to act. I do not deny that custom is usually narrow-minded and ungenerous. But one has no right to be outraged when, in self-defense, it martyrs the partisans of extreme acts. Any discipline, even that of the most sanctimonious custom, is better than none. That's one where I'm like, I don't know. But while I was occupied with my initial investigations into what I vaguely thought of as certitude, I felt obliged to reconsider all opinions which were presented to me. Consequently, I felt entitled to none myself. This open-mindedness raised certain problems as to how my life was to be guided for the interim, for while I questioned content, I did not want to lose form. I drew up, for the duration of this period of inquiry, the following provisional maxims of conduct and attitude. Number one, not to be satisfied with my own or anyone else's good intentions. Number two, not to wish for others what they did not wish for themselves. Three, not to spurn the advice of others. 4. not to fear disapproval, but to observe as much as feasible, as is feasible, the rules of tact and discretion. 5. Not to value possessions, nor be distracted by ambition. 6. Not to advertise myself, nor make demands on others. 7. Not to wish for a long life. And then she goes on to say, it's like, how these facets were actually very accessible to her, so she didn't actually have to try to access them.
That's an amazingly far-ranging paragraph. Oh my gosh. Sounds like a 14-year-old girl.
Yeah, well, you think? Well, it's about it. I mean, it's a story.
And she's already been through college. No, I love the idea, the isometrical ideas, and working through them. And of course, this is esoteric. You know, I have never worked through an asymmetrical idea, and so we must only. And she proves it. Some of her writing, like on this film by this German guy on Hitler, I can't believe, you know, the ideas that she. You know, that she uses to reproduce it. But oh man, what a paragraph. It's just kind of silly in the end. You know, it starts out so brilliantly and then just becomes absolutely silly. I just can't bear it. That's Camille Paglia's. What's so interesting about the Paglia Sontag antagonism is that's what Paglia criticizes her for, is leaving the university where you have to teach every day and where you have to, you know, do the work. And she's got a line in there that leftists who do not work are parasites of the bourgeoisie. And of course, that's her deepest dig against Sontag, is that Sontag is now read by aging bourgeoisie women in the 1990s, right? But yeah, I just keep going back to this.
But Sontag would never say that about anyone else. She would never say that thing.
She said that. I'm not going to even be mean to accept that. She refused to admit that she knew who Camille Paglia was, which was her one weakness, and which Camille Paglia uses throughout the whole essay, is that she's going to talk shows, and the talk show people are saying, and Susan Sontag still refuses to say that she even knows who you are. Is that correct? And Camille says, yes. So anyway, it just goes on and on.
Oh, fuck Camille Paglia.
Oh, no, you can't, man.
You can't just say... You can't say she was being a silly 14-year-old girl in that last passage and expect me to be
sympathetic. Oh, of course it is. Okay, come on. I'm not going to... I've written down 10 things. No, I totally... I'm not going to accept this. You write down, after you've already gone to college, and you write down all these moral judgments. Of course, she's, you know, Jewish, right?
These are not moral judgments. They're simply rules.
I'm not good at denying, you know, good advice people give me. I mean, it's kind of like Benjamin Franklin or something.
Yeah.
Come on, man.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. It's kind of
like that. Give me a break, man. That's pathetic. To begin a paragraph with these beautiful possibilities and end it with Hebraic law is just, like, too much for me, man. I mean, it's all good ideas, but I mean, look at me. I try hard every day to be a nice person, and I had a hard time, you know, not punching this guy today. You know, I mean, he had every right to say he didn't like this, you know, this book. I'm just saying that, you know, I'm sorry. It's not a great paragraph. It's banal, man. Did I pronounce it right? Starts out great. It starts out great. And I agree, and I will give Susan this, is that she followed through in her, you know, in her analysis and her criticism, she followed through quite well on that. Okay, now we're going to go on to a positive thing. Reading her essay on Walter Benjamin, she really loved that Walter Benjamin wrote very tiny script. She really loved about Walter Benjamin that he really paid attention to the smallest things and that he would collect really small things. I'm sorry, I haven't read the Benjamin thing, because that's another side of her. A side of her where she really loves a man who is going to have maps of his life, spatial, where he has red pens that lead to the apartments of girlfriends or parties he'd been through all through his life, right? And that he loved to collect tiny little memorabilia from little stores that he finds in isolated streets, right? And how important it is to be a collector. You know, all these things, and that really rang with me when you read the part about going from the complex to the very small. And
yeah.
You know, that's true. I think that's a wonderful thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, go to the smallest little tiny drawing that anybody has ever made, right? And get the magnifying glass out and check it out, right?
So,
there are charming themes in her psychology, no doubt about it.
As Feynman said, you know, there's plenty of room at the bottom. Yeah, getting into the quantum soup is, you know.
Plenty of room at the bottom. Yeah. I love that.
It's going to be the... Well, I don't know. I think by and large, my favorite essay from Sontag is this one about the aesthetics of silence, which is... kind of about how it's about language, as almost all of her writing is, but it's also about these guys like Wittgenstein, who like completely commit to saying what they're going to say and then stop, and they're just silent for the rest of their life. And it's kind of like, when have you decided that you've said all you could possibly say? And that to me is a pretty fascinating and complex idea.
In print.
Well, yes.
No, it's in print. Tractatus.
Well, no,
Logic.
Yeah.
Tractatus Mathematics Logicus, or whatever it is. I mean, that was pretty much it. But he taught for like another 20 years after that, and he did seminars at Harvard and Yale and all that.
Sure. So that's one of the other differences between spoken language and written language. Yeah. I just marked a passage, but I mean, you could kind of you could pick other passages out of this, but
go for it.
I thought this was particularly indicative of the podcast medium. Okay, so sometimes the accusation against language is not directed against all of language, but only against the written word. Thus, Tristan Tzara urged the burning of all books and libraries to bring about a new era of oral legends.
He was a Dadaist. For the general public.
Okay, yeah, I didn't really know.
And Dada is nihilist.
Dada's a nihilist?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's the art form, Dadaism. Basically, it was the original surrealism, the devaluation of beautiful ideas of aesthetics. You know, put a toilet in the corner and call it art.
Yeah.
Because your interpretation of it.
Yeah.
It's so interesting, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, thank you.
Well, I mean, you could almost argue that most kids nowadays could probably burn all their books and not care very much if they have the internet or whatever.
I don't know. I just don't think many people know who Tristan Tzara
is. Yeah. No, that was good. That was a good addendum. And of course, McLuhan, as everyone knows, makes the sharpest distinction between written language, which exists in visual space, and oral speech, which exists in auditory space. Praising the psychic and cultural advantages of the latter as the basis for sensibility. If written language is singled out as the culprit, what will be sought is not so much the reduction as the metamorphosis of language onto something looser, more intuitive, less organized and inflected, non-linear, in McLuhan's terminology, and noticeably more verbose. But of course, it's just these qualities that characterize many of the great prose narratives of our time. Joyce, Stein, Gatta, you know who Gatta is? Laura Riding, do you know who Laura Riding is? Beckett and Burroughs employ a language whose norms and energies come from oral speech with its circular, repetitive movements and a central first-person voice. Speaking for the sake of speaking is the formula of deliverance, Novalis said. Deliverance from what? From speaking? From art? In my opinion, Novalis has succinctly described the proper approach of the writer to language and offered the basic criterion for literature as an art. But to what extent oral speech is the privileged model for the speech of literature as an art is still an open question. And I I think it is still.
No, absolutely right. And that's how brilliant she is. She saw it all, because of course, Derrida and deconstructionism, values the spoken word. But I mean, this is a fallacy. I mean, everybody knows this is true if you're a writer, how, you know, every once in a while you can be brilliant for like 30 seconds, right?
Right.
But if you want to be really create something worth listening to, you got to write it down.
Yeah.
And that fed in, gentle listener, to the whole controversy of whether Homer was literate. In other words, whether he could write down, right? And there's so much evidence that, yes, it was written down, and that's how it was revised and condensed. And she touches upon that. The spoken language, yeah, you can be brilliant and verbose, right? And then somebody can figure out, well, you know what, if you wrote it down and just kind of like stylized it a little bit, then it would be really good, right? And they say that was true, you know.
But what makes that a controversy? What makes...
Well, no one knows, but writing has been around for a long time.
Oh, just the fact that no one knows.
That's the point, is that when we read the Iliad, there was this thing for a while that, oh, they just memorized it. They used the token epithets, sweethearted Athena, right? Because it fit the dithyramb. Dithyramb's not the right word. And
I don't even know what dithyramb means off the top of my head.
There's a double unstressed beat and a stressed beat or something.
Okay.
But anyway, and that is probably wrong in Greek. But all I'm saying is that for a while it was, they found these, in the 1900s, they actually found Yugoslavian poets who would recite all this poetry, and they just knew the story, and then they had these epithets down to fill out the beat, the eight-point beat, right?
Yeah.
And so they thought, Heidi, she's here to join our podcast. They thought that, I'll finish it.
Okay.
They thought that's the way it was passed down from generation to generation, right? But writing had been along much older than people thought about, and they thought, no, this work was written down and revised and then orally transmitted.
Right.
In other words, you had to learn it from the text,
right,
first.
Or as every child knows who's ever played telephone, you know, it's like you can't have a perfect... that game where you whisper like a word to somebody else and then the next person whispers it to the next person.
Right.
And exactly. It's like, yeah, and then at the end you got to figure out what the first person said.
Which is like gossip.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's like, well, obviously the fall down of the oral tradition. Like the oral tradition would have to be just one guy, one person sitting next to another person and like literally memorizing beat
right.
for beat.
Right, right.
And that would be just as complex as writing. So it's
right.
like, in a certain sense,
right.
that oral tradition is almost just writing, because you're creating a pocket of information and you're storing it in your memory bank the same way you would store a single word. Yeah.
Sure, sure. You have got, why not? Why act like I'm happy? Because basically, I'm not that happy, you know? And I'm singing about... you know, women that I've lost, I'm not that happy. I'm not happy about anything. I just put on a brave front.
Well, it's...
We should get this on the podcast.
I did.
It's on there, right?
No, it's not. He's lying.
I'm not. He's lying. I'm not. I would. You know, this is the most fascinating thing to me. It's like the fucking chaos of this episode. It's like, does that have something to do with the oral history? Is that what makes podcasts good? Actually, is like randomness, like jumping back and forth, like, or is it like professional editing? It's like, I don't know. I guess I've seen enough super professional ones. I might just cut this all together, just leave it fucking chaos, and just call that art or whatever.
Look,
or,
you know, Susan would be happy because basically I told you how one person tries to make something that has, that's going to sound good and will, and but I mean the deep part about it is, as Heidi knows, is that no, really, that's what my realization, why hide the fact that I'm, you know, that all this has hurt me? Why should I hide it? Which I have, you know.
From who? From yourself or from the world or
what? Well, everybody. Well, I'm always trying to be a nice guy and be funny and everything.
And from yourself, that's a good question.
Well, that's
we
the only question.
We do hide our sadness from ourselves.
Self-deception is the only question, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, as soon as you start with self-deception, everything's...
Exactly so, man. Just start from that as step one.
Yeah.
Everything is self-deception.
Yeah.
Absolutely, man.
Which is what I loved from that Burroughs quote I read in your book, which the book you have on your shelf, which is like, okay, which I was thinking about if I ever have a really professional interview again. Okay, what's your greatest strength? I think my greatest strength is to take a true accounting of myself and not lie about myself. What's your greatest weakness? I never do it.
Exactly.
It's such a good setup.
But it's a little kind of like background radiation.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, well, he's thinking about it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Deep background from the Great Bang vibrating through the universe. Well, I think that's true. And whether I'm going to be able to do this, but I am because I play 6 days a week. The first thing I do is...
Can I be honest with you? That
no,
voice you're talking...
Of course you can't. Because you're not either. Because I'm going to go with it right now, because it only works. But the other thing I learned from her is that, you know, again, you'll be really interested to know in terms of text. If I think of that line and I see the words there, I sing them crisper. It's like, dreamed about you, babe, just the other night. How you doing? Everything all right? If I see the words there, I sing them more condensed in time than if I just, emote, right? Which is the whole thing about aesthetics, man. I mean, this is what's so interesting. And again, we keep talking about the subjective truth and the objective. You can't go a subjective if you want to be an artist. You've always got to think of, okay, how is it going to be perceived? And I found that was interesting that, well, I know this song so well, I see the text.
That's exactly the opposite of what you just said.
Right.
I said,
I'm like, what?
Because I just said, can I give you my objective viewpoint or my subjective viewpoint? And you're like, no.
Of course.
I don't care about your perception.
Damn it.
I know.
I'm going to project and that's it. You like it or lump it.
This is why we do podcasts. This is tremendous. Oh my God, this might be the best one yet.
Or the worst. It's very hard to tell. It's very
well, you know, sometimes the worst is the best.
Yeah, right, yeah. The naked.
Like this guy said to me, production is never pretty, Will. You know, you got blood on the floor, you got shavings, you got trash, you got all this stuff on the floor, man. Production's never pretty.
That's true.
No, that's wonderful. No, you just, that I have to defend myself. I mean, this is like a momentary phase I'm in. I think it might work. So I'm going with it, you know.
Yeah.
And all I know is that I do, Heidi, I do have to hit the note. Dreamed about you, babe.
And I'm just more, the other dreamed night. About you, babe.
But you can sing,
so,
though.
I'm harmonizing.
Yeah. But you're a good singer, though. I know.
But if you're not a good singer. And
no,
like,
she naturally phrases really nice.
Right.
Where I don't.
Okay.
Because, you know, you got to sing a lot. Because basically, music, see, you've got this beat.
Well, let's,
and
let's,
you have
let's
to
talk
place,
about what you said about words condensed in time.
Well, I think the compression. I think the compression.
Compressed.
The same words, if you actually, like she naturally sings that way. Because if you listen to a lot of recordings, the difference between just being a little lazy with the time, like, dreamed about you, babe.
Yeah, you're kind of just
the other night.
Elongating
yeah.
your notes.
And it sounds okay. It sounds good.
Dreamed about you, baby.
If just it's, the other
night. But more. But in your it case, sounds it works good. When you're lazy because you're not hitting specific notes, right?
Jonah's like, given me this advice before, and I've agree with him, but really, in terms of when you listen to it recording, because I'm not a very good singer, if I compress those words a little, keep it a little closer, and I keep the beat, there'll be this really nice contrast between the beat.
Well, maybe instead of going high, you should go low, like you're Johnny Cash, like, dreamed about you, baby.
But that's the other problem, which I do well. That's my best singing style.
So maybe you should do that.
But
I like that.
I'm playing.
I like that. Will.
We gotta hire him.
That's an idea right there.
We got well.
Johnny Cash.
I can do that, but the interesting thing is that my playing a gut string guitar and just playing the bass, I'm hitting a lot of bass notes. So it's nice to get a little contrast there. So I'm thinking contrast twice, in time, and in terms of that. But you know, look, man. I'm such a great songwriter, it doesn't matter. All I got to do is just get them out so people will not say, hey, I'm not going to listen to this anymore. You know, I want them to hear the songs, hear the lyrics. They're never going to be...
What was that last sentence you said? I just want to get them out so people say I'm not going to... What?
I'm not going to throw it away because his singing is so sloppy, right? I mean, I'm working so hard on just playing a nice... cowboy beat.
No, but
right?
I think that's the thing that Sontag is talking about with like oral tradition. It's like it's not just her, maybe it's me too.
A lot of
it's
people.
Like it's like the aesthetics of you
right
is like truly realizing yourself is the best version of the aesthetics of you can ever do.
And we are our own worst critics.
I
gotta
cut out. Sometimes it's just a Jackson Pollock.
Yeah, exactly. So, see ya, Heidi.
See you tomorrow.
Did I run her off? I'm sorry. Or like, I don't understand.
She's a hard worker.
Okay.
She's just touching bases. Okay. Yeah. No, that's great. We got into some real, let's get in the aesthetics, how you do it. Yes, it's the shop room, man. I think you got some real insight into how things work and how you got to think about them. But you got to have some contrast, you know, and that's basic aesthetics is you got to have contrast.
But how do you expect to give? I mean, over like I'm gonna get really real. Over the last year, I have been mired in this obsession with the idea that, oh, how can I work anymore if nobody gives a shit about it? Like, I'm absolutely mired in that. I don't know where to go. There's either that aesthetic version of it's just you're doing it because you think it has value in and of itself, or and maybe that value has no context to the culture at large or whatever. It's like, and I know what I like and I make judgments about things very quickly, and I read a lot, you know. It's like I spend 4 or 5 hours as you do every day, like reading or listening to something or whatever, and I get blocked up in the idea of, well, maybe I just shouldn't be saying anything at all.
Well, that's the Van Gogh principle. Van Gogh never sells a painting, and he's got people promoting him. They can't deal with it, you know. I don't think it matters. I think it's all soul work, you know. I mean, the total dedication to doing something really beautiful. Aesthetics, according to my own terms of honor and honesty, and just how people are. That's why I think, that's why literature is so great, Jonah. You got to realize, man, literature, as opposed to music and painting, is the only art that can bring the soul of a woman, you know, into just the flicker of her, you know, right, into a page. And, you know, just the whole mystery, or a child. God, that's really interesting we're talking, because somebody once said 2 years ago that, well, there are no children in your book. And it's because I haven't been around children since, you know, mine were little. And I suddenly had this, because this girl came in here, and the way children use theatrical, you know, hand expressions, because they've seen people do it, and they go like, and this little girl came in here, and she just kind of threw out her palms and went, well, why don't you do it like this, right? Or something like that. And I thought, God, how fresh, how beautiful, and how they're just like going, how am I going to make an impact and have somebody get what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
And they're picking up the clues, and they're working so hard. It's so beautiful. And I thought, God, maybe I can work that little girl into one scene, you know, like Errol, you know. You know, you worry about all this, but, you know...
Well, that's Kundera. I'm going to bring up Kundera again, just to hit my Kundera quota for the podcast. Yes. It's the immortality of gestures, you know, it's like... What you say about personalities or whatever, there's only a certain amount of possible gestures you can do.
Right.
And, yeah, and that's his whole thing with immortality, is the longing for immortality, you know, the fingers to the chest and then opening up.
Right. And that is immortality.
Yeah.
That is something that will be done in every...
Versus
every generation for
versus
thousands.
What you were doing, which is like the shoulders and then the bending at the elbows and then saying why, you know, it's like, oh, you know, it's like
right, exactly. So
I mean, you can really dive into gestures in a really interesting way.
That's wonderful. It's really wonderful. Yeah, you know, I was reading Eugene O'Neill, and his plays are like so heavily orchestrated in terms of gesture and positioning and everybody. And man, he got the Nobel Prize, right?
Well, I mean, that's
but it's a big thing about it. You're right. And God, good. That's so great. This will be so wonderful. You know, you feel this futility, Joan, but just think, people will be listening to this podcast and I'll think, how did Kundera get into every broadcast? Sooner or later, man. You think there's no way. It's only 5 minutes to go. There's no way that we're going to get him in there. But the truth of what he said is like so spectacular.
Well, I don't know. It's just... It's like you just have a few things that just never leave your brain. Which, okay, to be fair, I was being very defensive of Sontag. But also, on another level, she's very first person. You never really get the sense she's ever embodied anyone other than herself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying I would ever hold that against her, but she's got another whole section that's basically just her, and then it's like an interrogation with myself, a wandering with myself.
Right, but I must make the obvious, you know, observation that when you write an essay, is first person.
Right, but she did write a couple novels, and they're included in the reader, or bits of them. Right. The one I'm quoting is a piece of fiction.
Yeah, I started reading Volcano Lover, and I have to agree with Camille Paglia on that. It was like, God, this is really bad.
Yeah, it's not very good.
It's really
bad. There's some kind of interesting stuff in The Benefactor, which is this young man trying to realize that his dreams are going to be his work. He's going to spend all his time just interpreting his dreams,
right?
Which is interesting. I mean,
that's the Walter Benjamin. That's how she channels Walter Benjamin.
Mm, yeah, maybe.
Yeah, it's the subjective, the untrammeled, untethered intellectual life.
Yeah.
That the great mystics and the great intellectuals, Van Gogh, you know. That's the essence of it, man. It's how do you live this totally free intellectual artistic life, right? and
how
do you? Yeah. And that's what you're doing, man. And
well, there is no how. It's just you.
Yeah, you
there's
just,
no how.
Gee, you just do it, and but you're gonna take your shots, man. I mean, that's you're alienated, and that's what I love about Sontag. That alienation comes with this. You will always be alienated from your society. And to go back to the real schism between Paglia and Sontag is that Sontag believes in alienation. She believes that alienation is the price of being a true human being and a true artist. And Camille Paglia says, no, pop culture, man, come on, let's get in the mainstream. Let's do some stuff that's going to be spectacle, right? So I think it's poignant in the end is that I don't think Camille realized that there was, it wasn't that Didion disliked her or didn't admire her, she just totally disagreed with her in her fundamental approach to life, right?
Yeah, that's beautiful. That, and I don't know if we've properly explained that in the beginning of the podcast, but Paglia and Sontag had a falling out, and well, not a falling out, but as you said before the podcast started, Camille Paglia would be like on talk shows, and then they'd ask if Sontag had ever acknowledged that she existed or knew who she was, and she'd say no, she still never has. So that's the context for what you just said, which should have been before, but. Unfortunately, I bungled that.
We got back to it.
Yeah.
But yeah, tremendous pain. There's more pain, I think, in Camille Paglia about it than in Sontag.
Of course, because she's not self-realized.
Yeah, of course.
She's having more pain.
Yeah, exactly.
Because she's the...
And she's found her finder. She's found her... what's the great line? So-and-so's got her gig or her... style, yeah, and she has been rejected by the woman she loved intellectually, right? But yeah, I mean, Sontag is like totally the opposite. It's just what we're talking about.
Yeah.
So what are you reading?
Well, I was going to read something on the Walter Benjamin essay.
Great.
Which, again, maybe you'll hate because it's something to me that is, when I see it, I'm like, yes, I know exactly what. The mark of the Saturnine temperament is the self-consciousness and unforgiving relation to the self, which can never be taken for granted. The self is a text. It has to be deciphered. Hence, this is an apt temperament for intellectuals. The self is a project, something to be built. Hence, this is an apt temperament for artists and martyrs, those who court the purity and beauty of a failure, as Benjamin says of Kafka. And the process of building a self and its works is always too slow. One is always in arrears to oneself. Things appear at a distance, come forward slowly. In Berlin Childhood, he speaks of his propensity to see everything I care about approach me from far away. The way, often ill as a child, he imagined the hours approaching his sickbed. This is perhaps the origin of what others call patience in me, Benjamin said. But which in truth does not resemble any virtue. Of course, others did experience it as patience, as a virtue. Schlemm has described him as the most patient human being I ever came to know. But something like patience is needed for the melancholic labors of decipherment.
It's brilliant. I mean, it's one of the great... I didn't say at the beginning of the show or earlier before you turn it on, her essay on Walter Benjamin is one of the greatest things ever written in terms of what we're talking about. You know, they're just absolute truths, you know, that she just nails so beautifully with Benjamin as her accomplice, right?
Yeah, they're
fellow travelers, and, you know, but she also throws some really beautiful lines in there in the middle. I also have to say that Van Gogh said the same thing. It's when you suffer, you see life from a great distance. And, alienation, right? And I mean, you just get in, speaking of ambiguity, I mean, you just get into a mirror world of paradoxes, you know, the whole idea of identity and observing yourself and observing the world, right? And observing yourself as you're trying to observe the world, right? I mean, this complex thing that's going on that a really great writer and thinker does.
Well, I was talking to you about this the other week, and it's something that's still on my mind, is like, I heard about this idea that there's a thing as not having imagination, aphantasia, there's literally a biological component to not having imagination. Somebody can literally not have one.
And you need imagination to observe yourself.
Right. Yes. Well, to put yourself in context to anything, right? So, like, if anything could be at a distance, well, you would need imagination for that to be possible. And when I was a child, that was my big nightmare. Was I'd fall asleep, and I could hear something. I could hear it, but I could never see it. It was always perpetually far away. And then, in a split second, it'd run up on top of me, and then. It was a knight with a lance, and it would run through, and it would kill me, and then I'd wake up, and that was my nightmare. That was my nightmare of like not being able. It was just too far. It was like a little pinprick, and then all of a sudden, it was kind of like that.
That's great.
You ever see that thing from Monty Python where John Cleese's character or whatever is like running in the distance, and it goes dum da dum da dum da dum da dum. And he's running towards the castle, and then there's the guys guarding the castle, and they're just waiting, and then it just cuts back to him, and he's going dum da dum da dum da dum da dum. It's such a strange joke. It's such a bizarre, weird joke. It's like, what is the joke about? Is it about a charge in a movie? How a charge seems false, and then. It's, I don't know, but you've talked to me about differences of perception all the time.
Oh yeah, I think children really have these. I did too. I would have this feeling that I was very small, and then all of a sudden I was like, boom! I was like, out into outer space, but I was that size. It was like this vertiginous going from being really small, like boom, like way out there, you know, and yeah. Well, you know, all we can figure out is John Cleese had this same nightmare, you know?
Yeah, well, maybe.
Yeah.
Well, but the question buried in that is, are artists biologically different?
Mm-hmm.
That's my question. Because, you know, most people, when they assume, like, they would say something to me, they'd be like, oh, you must have a good imagination. I'd be like, well, everybody has an imagination.
Right.
But obviously, that's not true.
Right.
Obviously, there's varying degrees of imagination.
Sure. Sure, and well, I think you're right. And, you know, I hope somebody doing a PhD in psychology at UCLA or MIT is listening to this.
Yeah.
Because, yes, are we biologically different? It's totally possible, man. But, you know, as we all always look at it in terms of class or race, right?
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, really poor kids will grow up like Dvorak, you know, the son of a meat cutter. And, geez, what an imagination this guy's got musically, right? And a sensitivity. So yes.
Well, that means class and race
has no meaning. It's just like every once in a while you get to human beings that are. But Noah, you made a really interesting point that the main thing about imagination is to place yourself in a context which takes tremendous imagination, you know? And but the fact that you're doing it unconsciously, just naturally, right? Some people never experience this. They're just... Actually, now we're entering a nightmare world. I mean, I can just imagine living life like some of these people that are around us, in which, what is their life like? Is it like so fearful, astonishing?
No, it's better without imagination, I think. It's better. That's my supposition. I mean, it's like in on the porn.
That's my supposition. Is better without imagination.
Yeah. Like in so well, you generally hate this kind of thing. So I was. Gonna...
It's better, but are you more comfortable?
Well, so Sontag wrote this thing on the pornographic imagination.
Okay.
And she made this interesting distinction about how science fiction and pornography are very closely related. and oh my gosh. But the pornographic imagination is not just to be understood as a form of psychic absolutism, some of whose products we might be able to regard in the role of connoisseur rather than client, with more sympathy or intellectual curiosity or aesthetic sophistication. Several times before in this essay, I've alluded to the possibility that the pornographic imagination says something worth listening to, albeit in degraded and often unrecognizable form. So, see, this is why I should have prepared more. I've got 10 different thoughts swimming around my brain, and I can't pick the best.
Well, I mean, you can overreach your bounds, you know. I mean, obviously Susan Sontag will talk about anything.
No, well,
and,
no.
I think we were on something even quite a bit more profound, you know, and I can't even remember what it was now. But again, you know, you got to realize that, you know, just the very mention of pornography, you talk about ambiguity as or aesthetics as a concept. Talk about pornography, okay? I mean, you got something that how do you even talk about it, man? I mean,
well, I mean, gosh. that's the challenge to the intellectual is like, okay, here's something that's sort of beyond what's talking about.
Right, but the whole point is it worth talking about?
Yeah.
You know, and I don't see it worth talking
yes,
about
Yes, but
myself.
That's the whole point. If there's something...
Hey, man, I grew up Lutheran. Come on.
So did I. I went to a private Christian school, so,
No, there is no doubt that reading Lady... God, we're going to bring up D.H. Lawrence twice. Lady Chatterley's Lover is pornographic, but it's beautiful. I mean, in the whole context of the whole thing, man. I mean, it's really spectacular.
Okay, I mean, well, the essence of what I was going to try and say and look up, which for some reason I couldn't find, and I just threw the book on the floor and it split open because it was an old copy.
It did, gentle listener. This text is now open like black text. And it's page 442. Work is genuinely subversive, liberating, playful. It is outlaw discourse in the great aesthete tradition, which often assumes the liberty of rejecting the substance of discourse in order better to appreciate its form. Outlaw discourse turned respectable, as it were, with the help of various theories known as varieties of formalism. In numerous accounts of his intellectual evolution, Barth described himself as the perpetual disciple, but the point that he really wants to make is that he remains finally untouched. What? How could she like him?
Well, she's
I mean,
not,
how could you say that you're untouched?
I mean, that's the thing with criticism too.
What,
it's like
what?
for every brilliant line, you've got to write like two or three bullshit ones. You know?
Right. That's the problem that she quotes him, and she didn't say what bullshit. He spoke as of his having worked under the aegis of a succession of theories and masters. Well, there's a problem. Why would you want to work under a series of masters? That's the thing about people. It's just not in the Western tradition to work under a series of masters. You know, it's our tradition to live as free men,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And have some time to develop our own, you know, spirituality, our own thoughts about the world, and read books, read constantly, right?
Yeah.
But having interpreters, and again, that's where we get back to the whole weak terrain of whether it's Camille Paglia or Susan Sontag. Why do we need these people? If they're good, yes. And I mean, the piece you read on Benjamin is so brilliant. Yeah, you read it, but you got to sift out, man. I mean, half of it isn't going to be that good.
But that, you know, it's like, that's the work of reading. I mean, I would assume the same thing about my writing. It's like, yeah, it's like more than half of it isn't that good. I mean, that's how engaging with the text works is, yeah, if you want to really get something out of something, you got to put a little effort in.
Right.
In order to get something out of it.
Right, no, absolutely. Well, that's how great my egotism is. All my novel is great. I love it. Every bit of it is great.
Every sentence.
Well, no, I'm doing a lot of rewriting now. I'm doing a lot. I'm going through it. But no, it's tremendous.
Okay, the one idea from the pornographic imagination that I remember is that essentially, like religion, in the pornographic imagination, there are very few people who ever reach the heights of the ecstasy that is portrayed, right? Just like there's most of the people who ever go to church have religious sensations, or, you know, it's kind of like that. She's making a comparison of like, yeah, like most people who go never reach those ultimates, and that idea of the ultimate is what, I don't know, it's sort of like cathartic or whatever. It's like allows people to ignore the senses of their depravity, which are actually innate to them, like biologically or carnalistically or whatever.
You know? Right. Well, you're in such dangerous territory here, Jonah.
Dangerous to whom? Who's this dangerous?
To everybody. I mean, really, it's just like totally... You've got all these hypothetical pornographic addicts on one side, then you've got people going to a Baptist church, you know, so they'll feel a little, you know, I mean, you really...
Well, what's
you're
dangerous really, about that? It's just true, right?
Oh, well, it's not dangerous there. It's you're trying to mix all these into one, like in 1 minute. Are you kidding me? I mean, this is like ridiculous.
I would rather be dangerous than not dangerous.
Well, the method is dangerous. Well, okay, I'll use a better word. It's just like totally ineffectual. How's that?
Ineffectual?
I mean, oh, absolutely, man. I mean, Jesus Christ. To go. So you're paraphrasing Sontag's, counterbalancing analogy. The word is analogy. And,
It's almost like a riff on satire. It's like anti-satire.
Basically, you're getting into really tricky, phenomenological, epistemological terrain in which each one of these little concepts you're making is going to require some, like, okay, let's get some definitions here. Let's figure out exactly what's going on.
And that's what she does.
What are the motivations? Yeah. Which you ignored, and you got to get the motivations, and the intent, and the psychopathology as well, in both. I mean, that's why I can see the validity of the analogy, because there are pathologies in both, right?
Yeah.
So I can go with that, but let's not just do this in like the last 5 minutes of the broadcast, man. Holy moly.
Fair enough.
Holy moly, man. We'll do this next week. Susan Sontag, chapter 2.
Oh, I don't know. This one's such a mess. I don't know. I can't do 2 this messy. I'd rather do Cormac McCarthy again.
No, we'll do it too. We'll analyze Sontag's... she would approve. Let's take one of her essays, Pornography and Religion... And
the
just
pornographic
like look
imagination.
Let's just take it and just analyze that. That's the way to do it.
No, I feel like that's a terrible idea.
Thank you, because I don't want it to either.
Yeah. But considering how much resistance you had to what I just said.
Well, at least we have postponed it to another time, right? Yeah. No, I think it was tremendous. I think it's tremendous. With some good editing, it's going to be really good. We have to thank our editor, Jonah Andrest, for bringing. You can't believe how messy these are before he works on them a little bit.
I don't know.
And how much he's compensated for them.
Oh, yes. Hugely. It's not like I've only lost money in my attempts to make art. I've only ever lost money. I have only ever lost money.
That's one of the great ambiguous grammatical constructions, but we know what you meant.
Well, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I've only ever lost money. That's true, man. Tremendous. Good deal. I think it was a great. I think it was tremendous. I had a ball, man.
All right. Well, that's good enough for me.
And Susan's gonna be
happy. As long as you're happy, I'm happy.
There you go, man. And Susan's happy.